It's not a Midsummer Night's Dream, everybody. It's a Midsummer Afternoons podcast and live stream called Random Assignment. That is the great Corey DeAngelis. Hey, Corey.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, you know, it's hot in here, and I rigged up a fan. I'm hoping the fan is not, like, blowing into the microphone. Is that okay?
I think it sounds fine. Where are you at? Are you in New Jersey right now? Are you in Texas?
I am in New Jersey, yeah, exactly. New Jersey. Yeah, it's a pretty hot day, though. Okay, so we had the week off, so there's more, maybe double than usual kinds of stories going on. Some people may have thought that this COVID thing, at least in the U.S., this COVID thing is mostly over. You might have thought that if you did things like, go to restaurants or, I mean, all kinds of things are open up. I'm not sure if anything is mostly, if anything's still closed in really any states. Is there anything closed still? Are movie theaters closed in any state, Corey? Do you know?
I hope not. Live music concerts?
Pardon?
I mean, I'm in DC, and so you would think it would be worse here than just about anywhere else. And everything's pretty much open. The concerts are started back up again. I think the U.S. is pretty much open when it comes to concerts and restaurants.
And yet when it comes to schools, this mask, in the one population least affected by COVID are kids in schools. And yet we're hearing that there are all kinds of states saying, oh, boy, we got to really worry about children catching COVID in the fall. And that some of these states are saying, if you don't come with a mask, little kid, get out. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but tell me your view.
Yeah, I mean, this is the title of our show today. 9 states say no mask, no learning, at least in-person learning it. And what I came across today that was pretty interesting, I was keeping up with what was going on in California. And so I wondered how many states have mask requirements. So Burbio actually has a map, which is an organization that had a school reopening map. They also now have a map on school mask policies. And you can see states that are in dark blue are states that have mask requirements from the state that are mandated for all schools. The dark green states have they have a mandate that you cannot compel students to wear masks in public schools. So Texas, for example, it's the opposite. They're totally free. And in blue states, dark blue on the map, at least, which California also happens to be a politically blue state as well. Schools are mandated to have mask requirements, all schools. And then in the middle, there's this light green color, which is no mask mandate. But localities have flexibility. They can make the decision for each individual school district. Then there's a blue, some states that are in blue that are contingent upon having the vaccine. So if you are vaccinated, you don't have to wear the mask as a kid in school. If you are not, you are required to wear the mask at school.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no vaccine yet, which is even has emergency approval for kids that are young, that are under 12, right? That's nope. The extent to which any kids have vaccines, it's the over 12 group. So I guess what those states are saying, those vaccinated, I guess it's just 3 of them. You showed there, Michigan and West Virginia and something. Those states are saying, you know, I would say ironically, the youngest kids for whom there is no vaccine, for whom also COVID affects the least are the ones who for sure will have to wear the mask because they won't have vaccines.
I haven't seen any studies to suggest that masking in schools has led to lower transmission in schools or in the communities overall.
There's not been one.
I haven't seen any legitimate study finding that. So they're doing this just based off of feelings and an overabundance of caution, which we've seen over the past year. That's been the story of the past year. Everybody has just taken the cautious approach, which has led to real harm in unintended ways to children by keeping the schools closed. And there may be adverse effects of being masked for so long as a young kid, which mostly does not have, there mostly isn't a risk associated with these lower age groups. So, I mean, the main takeaway is here, there's there's nine of these states: North Carolina, Virginia, New York, California, New Mexico, Washington, and some others. Nine states total are currently requiring all schools to have mandatory masking. And what's weird about California, and I know you saw this, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
There was a flip.
I was about to bring that up. Go ahead.
In California, that at first I was like, what is going on here? So you see the title in the Los Angeles Times, and an abrupt turnaround, California to let school districts decide how to enforce mask rules. So the initial announcement was that the state of California was going to enforce mask rules for all students in all schools. But the turnaround wasn't as big of a turnaround as I thought it was. It wasn't that they were lifting their mask ban, which is what I originally thought when I saw all these headlines yesterday. Instead, it was, well, it's still a state mandate, but the enforcement is going to be carried out by the local school districts.
I think some are interpreting that is kind of to say, if they choose not to enforce the state mandate, that'll be up to them. So I think it's kind of this wishy-washy resolution where, yeah, you're right. The original language was rather draconian. In this LA Times article, it says, the original language, quote, schools must exclude students from campus if they are not exempt from wearing a face mask under California Department of Public Health guidelines and refuse to wear one provided by the school. So that was schools must exclude students. That was very clear, triggering this giant backlash. But rather than do what I think you and I would say would be at least just leave it up to the districts. I mean, at least just do that. The risks of children catching this disease, I think the risks of the mass are worse than the risk of the disease for that cohort, that demographic, kids that young. But instead of just saying we're going to leave it up to safety, they kind of were like, it was almost like a child who doesn't want to admit they're wrong, but so they kind of change it or something. I don't know. Anyway, you get the idea. They were like, okay, well, we're not going to reverse our policy, but we're just going to let you violate it if you want, because it's up to you to enforce it. So. Anyway,
still a state mask mandate.
Let me add one more thing. This to me is emblematic of the larger COVID policy problem that I've seen from the beginning, which is what it should have been all along, was a balance between minimizing human suffering from the virus versus minimizing human suffering from the lockdowns and masks and reaction, minimizing those two bad things. Instead, so many policymakers, particularly in the blue states, said, no, we don't even care about that other side of the ledger. That the suffering from lockdowns, the suffering from masks, the suffering from lost learning, that will just be considered zero. We will only look at one thing, which is infection rate. We will only look, we won't even look at demographics of who's infected. We will just look at this one metric and that's it. And ordinary people in life balance things. If they have to deal with something negative, they balance the negative versus the negative because of the cure, the concept that the cure can't be worse than the disease. Real people in real lives balance these things, including these people in their real lives, by the way, too. But with this one public policy issue, they decided, I believe, in my opinion, it was politically advantageous to say we should only look at the virus side and pretend there are no negative effects to things like making an 8-year-old wear a face covering and socially distance. I think there are negative effects, but that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, we can't ignore the negative effects of the government policies that restrict personal freedom. I think families are more likely to make the decisions themselves that work best for their families. And look, the teachers all have access to the vaccines in the schools, and most of the children over the age of 12 have access as well. And families can make the choice based on their own family situations. So the NEA had their annual meeting, and I think we already talked about this on a recent podcast, unless it's been that long.
No, we did.
And they removed a bunch of stuff from the website. But one of the things that they defeated at the national meeting was a requirement. The NEA had a proposal to back a requirement for all kids and all students and staff to be vaccinated in order to reopen the schools. And that was submitted by a bunch of delegates from California. Well, they defeated this at the national level, but do you think there could be a possibility of perhaps Los Angeles Teachers Union or some teachers union in California calling to require vaccines to reopen certain schools?
I think it depends on the answer to one question, which is, does the union see a lane to holding the districts hostage regarding a new variant? If they see a lane to say, we will miss, and I'm not saying nobody's actually concerned about a new variant. That's obviously, there are some people concerned about new variants, but let's not pretend this other factor is not here, which is a lane to make money, regardless of whether there's any, you know, significant risk based on what an ordinary person would consider reasonable doubt. I don't know, reasonable levels of risk. There's always risk in life, right? There's people die on roads and highways every day. And we don't say, let's have a 5 mile an hour speed limit on the highways, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because we decide that a certain amount of risk is something that is a reasonable level of risk. So in my view is if there's the new Delta variant, and then it's the new Gamma variant or the new Omega variant or the new some other variant, and they're like, oh my gosh, look, now we've got to close schools again, knowing behind the scenes they can go to the district and be like, if you want us to come back, we're going to need these new things granted in contracts. If there's a lane for that, they'll do it. It's as simple as that. They'll do it. They'll shut down schools again to demand money. There's no doubt.
It worked in Los Angeles public schools. We shared a couple of weeks ago that their per pupil funding went from $17,000 per kid in 2020. And then in this budgeted school year, 2021-2022, went up by about 50% to around $26,000-$27,000 per kid. So they got a lot of what they wanted by keeping the schools closed. So yeah. Who knows what they're going to do. I'm still waiting. I mean, it's still summertime and we'll see what'll happen. But I can't help but notice the president of the American Federation of Teachers continuously tweeting about the Delta variant and how important it is to get vaccinated for schools to open and that being the path to open schools, when a lot of people are sitting back and saying, well, I thought all the schools were supposed to open in the fall regardless. What are you talking about this being the path to opening schools? I thought the conversation already had been that everyone is planning to open in the fall. So we'll see what happens. You're muted, Bob. I didn't do it either. Well, while Bob's messing with that, we should get to the next story really quickly. I guess I always like to talk about the school choice wins that we've seen over the past couple of weeks. And the American Federation for Children actually has a new map. We call the page School Choice Victories. And you can go through all of the states that have passed, expanded, or enacted new programs to fund students instead of systems. There are 17 states already this year, and you can go into each of the states and see what actually changed and the details of the changes in each state. 17 states have expanded funding students instead of systems over the past year alone, and we're calling it the year of school choice. And when you open this page, you can see an actual map of these victories, and you can scroll over the victories. The green is an expansion of an existing program. States with blue splotches, they've enacted new programs. So, for example, you have New Hampshire, the Live Free or Die state, has a new education savings account program, will be the second largest in the nation. West Virginia is going to have the biggest education savings account program in the nation. Kentucky passed the third biggest education savings account program in the nation. So there's a pretty big school choice wave moving. We also include improvements to programs in orange. I'll add Bob back to the stream. Bob, can you there?
I can talk. Can you hear me now?
Sweet. Yeah, now we can hear you again. I was going over some of the school choice wins. I went over them pretty quickly, but there's also a piece at Forbes, if you want to look into it more, by Mike McShane, who's at EdChoice. It's called School Choice Keeps Winning. And the latest win, I broke the news today, was when Governor Mike Parson from Missouri just signed an education savings account program into law today. So that's getting some traction on Twitter. And in fact, this will be the first private school choice program in the state of Missouri ever. They already had some charter schools on the ground, not a ton of them. Now they're going to have this pretty expansive bill, which is an education savings account. They're calling them empowerment scholarship accounts. House Bill 349, if you want to look into it, if you're in Missouri.
Yes, indeed. Why do you think school choice is winning? Because there's been some speculation in our little world on this lately.
Yeah, right? I saw that piece.
Yes. So some say it's simply the COVID and simply not just the idea that that kids weren't learning during the COVID lockdowns when there's supposed to be this online, you know, work, but another factor, which is parents suddenly became aware of what was being taught in some of the classrooms. And that's another way that COVID drove school choice. But then there's also the kind of woke movement. And some say parents are being scared away from public schools for that reason. Go ahead.
Are you talking about the Fordham piece on this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the pandemic answer is, even though it's the simplest answer, it is the correct answer, that people started to see that school system isn't really responsive to their needs. Teachers unions showed their true colors, kept the doors closed as long as possible. And the reason I say that is, one, we've seen huge jumps over the past year in support with opinion polling from EdChoice, from Real Clear Opinion Research polling, from Harvard University polling, jumps in support for educational freedom. And then the biggest jumps were among families in the public school system and then also among Democrats. I know Mike Petrilli in his piece had made the argument that if the argument I just made was correct, he argued that we would see more victories in blue states with school choice. And I don't think that's true at all. I mean, you could have support rising for school choice in California, but it not be a particularly well-positioned state to get it done in the legislature. I mean, you can have everybody supporting the policy and more likely to support the policy than last year and still not get a legislative victory.
But you could have a huge rise, in other words, in parental support while the legislators in that state are still bought off by the union. So in other words, I think there's an inertia to the legislative movement that doesn't exist with parents when they suddenly become dissatisfied with what their kids are learning in the online class.
And a lot of the states that did get expansions, it's true, as Petrilli points out, were red states, but there are also states that were on the cusp that we couldn't get before. And then this provided even more support and more ammunition to get it over the line and actually get the job done in those states. So I think it was part of the failure of the public schools over the past year. And you know, yeah, the red states were more likely to be open, but that didn't mean they were open the whole time. You still had certain districts that weren't open. And you also had everyone in the United States peering into the public schools through the remote systems of learning, where they started to see the CRT stuff and maybe other things that were politically polarizing in the classroom. And that did upset parents in red states and some blue states too. And I think that you can't really disentangle that from the pandemic. It's part of what the pandemic and the school closures and teachers unions pushing for these school closures for extended periods of time allowed families to look into the classrooms even more.
So it's a little out of order, but if you could pull up the Real Clear story on unions' focus on wokeness and wokeness rankling the rank and file. I found this interesting because that's the story. And what it's about is it talks about a particular teacher who is suing the Los Angeles suing to leave UTLA and demanding a refund of union dues collected since the resignation request. Now, you wonder why they need to sue for that. Since the Janus decision, they ought to be able to, not have to sue to get. But at any rate, they talk about this one teacher, Glenn Laird, and what I thought was interesting was the fact that, this person says, quote, "I would much prefer a union focus completely on wages, hours, and working conditions. When the union goes into political activist mode, I think it dilutes the practice of what the union is supposed to be doing." And so, but yet it says these kinds of pushbacks are not affecting, the actual the actual unions. They talk about a week before the teachers union president called for defunding the police. And there was no problem, you know, doing that, as we've talked about the Los Angeles Teachers Union doing. And that, in fact, the rhetoric, this is the most interesting paragraph I found just under the photo a little. It says, Trumka's departure from traditional union rhetoric reflects both labor's relative weakness and the recognition that its failure will depend less on conservative lunch pail workers than on progressive professionals in tech and elsewhere for whom values and social justice are key concerns. Describing there just a sudden change in what unionization is about for all of my lifetimes. It was to reach out to the working class, as they describe, lunch pail type workers who wants a better salary and wants a better pension and wants better working conditions and might want some vacation. And there's this now, this shift it's describing to, no, maybe our real future is, are the progressive high-tech liberals, and we need to appeal to them more than the first group.
So why do you think this has changed with the teachers unions? Could it be that they just have such a massive monopoly that they don't really have to be responsive to the members, that members are just sitting there like, well, I don't like what's going on, but I can exit now after Janice, but where else do I go? I think that's kind of the situation that people are in.
Yeah, I think they feel like that group is locked in, and also big tech and big tech censorship is insurging. It's on the rise. It feels like the power is moving in that direction. And maybe they kind of want more of the BLM woke crowd, big tech, they want that momentum applied to the union movement, and they feel like they'll get more power by wooing those types than they are going to lose members who are the lunch pail unionists. It's an interesting analysis, I thought. it's already well into the hour, aren't we? So let's bring up a video. So speaking of kind of wokeness, I wanted to bring up a video from Illinois, this being a teacher who's suing the school district of Skokie and Evanston. And I found, and her lawyer went on TV, actually, the Fox affiliate there, to talk about the lawsuit. And I was kind of amazed by how bold this was. This is a story of a district that formally separated white teachers from non-white teachers into two different rooms to give them two different trainings. And the lawyer described it in such an interesting way. They separated people by skin color as official government policy. So listen to this.
A middle school drama teacher is suing the Evanston Skokie School District in federal court. Stacey DeMar, who is white, claims the teacher training and lessons about race and racism discriminated against her.
DeMar is represented by a conservative law firm based in Georgia, and attorney Kimberly Herman from the Southeastern Legal Foundation joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So the district is doing several things. One of them is actually segregating its teachers in its teacher training by their skin color. So you put the white teachers in one room and the non-white teachers in another room, and you actually give them different trainings. They're doing this with their students also. The 14th Amendment to our Constitution prohibits this. You cannot treat people differently because of their race. End stop. Segregation ended in this country 70 years ago. We had National Guardsmen actually going in to enforce these desegregation orders. They were that important, and they should have been, and they still should be today. This has got to stop.
I have a lot of follow-up questions for you, but I'll just start with this one. One thing you mentioned is the use of a children's book called Racism is a White Person's Problem, and we are all caught up in it. Why shouldn't we teach white children about racism and the many ways that it permeates our society?
Yeah, this isn't about whether or not we should teach children about racism. This is about what we are telling our students to actually think. When you read through this book, it is teaching, quite frankly, it is teaching non-white students to hate, and it is teaching white students to hate themselves. When you have a picture of a white person dressed as a devil, telling the students that whiteness is a bad deal, right? And telling students that they need to sign away their whiteness and asking them to sign this contract, or in the classroom, saying an anti-racist pledge and putting it up on the board to look at every single day, you are telling students that they are either oppressed or the oppressor solely because of their skin color. Let's get back to teaching people to look at the inside of people and not put skin color as the only thing that we are looking at about a person.
Okay, I know that is a book that's got a lot of accolades, including from Oprah Magazine, said it's a good place to start talking about racism. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end the discussion.
I wanted to point out that at the very end, the interviewer had to swipe in something positive about the book.
Oh, I know.
No, we got to go. I'm not going to keep talking with you, but it's actually a really great book.
And the official test of ethical purity, which is the Oprah Magazine, has endorsed the book as if that's the proxy for what is good and right and worthwhile. The Oprah Magazine. Oh, well, Oprah Magazine likes it. So, gee, how could you possibly? I mean, please. How do you like that lawyer, though, with the line, "You cannot treat people differently because of their race." Mm-hmm. End stop. Mm-hmm. Would our friends who are sympathetic to the critical race theory concept dispute that? Would they say this woman is wrong? You should be able to treat people differently because of their race. Otherwise, how would we pursue this CRT curricula appropriately? Yeah, I don't actually even know the answer to the question I just asked.
Well, I think most people who are defending CRT in the classroom want what they believe to be the true version of CRT. And I think this whole conversation about all of these things that are happening in certain school districts that make it to the news, I want to think that most people who defend CRT in the classroom are not okay with the affinity group trainings, and especially when you're doing that with individual kids and separating them by race. In a large part, two groups for and against CRT in the classroom are just talking past each other. On the one hand, you have the families who have legitimate concerns about what's going on in their kids' classroom when they point to individual instances of things happening. And then you have the other end, which seems to be upset about people using the term critical race theory when they don't believe that they want true critical race theory in the classroom, but they don't want what the parents are pointing out happening in the classroom. Right. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the best solution, and you already know this, Bob, and the listeners already know this, Bob, is don't force people to have a one size fits all curriculum in a one size fits all system. It's never going to work out. There's going to be constant battles, and Neil McCluskey at Cato Institute has been tracking this for years. He's called this for years. A diverse population of people in a country with hundreds of millions of individuals, we're going to disagree on what our kids should learn in the classroom, and that should be okay. And we should be okay with saying, you know what, if you want to have your child raised in that way in this environment, you should be allowed to do that. But at the same time, you shouldn't be able to force my kids to stay in that environment and to learn those values that I disagree with fundamentally. And I should be able to take my kids' education dollars to a school that aligns with my values. And then we don't have to have these battles. And I think there isn't any other solution, peaceful solution, to these battles. Otherwise, it's just we're screaming at each other at school board meetings. Most, no matter what decision is made, you're going to have a large segment of the population not happy with that decision one way or the other.
Well, this is why I brought up the question to you before about whether, you know, the cause for the school choice wins around the country. I believe part of this is driving it. There's a part of me that says, go, keep doing it, districts. Keep ordering, keep indoctrinating more and more and more. Never stop. Actually, tell them everything. They must believe exactly like you. If there's anything you think that they don't think, just punish them, somehow shame and abuse them until they are, you know, mocked and ridiculed into being ordered into groupthink. Go ahead, keep doing it. Push groupthink. It's fantastic for the school choice movement. So there's part of me that kind of thinks that. Mm-hmm. I would say this, though, in my kind of higher-minded self, it would be helpful for the people you describe who are generally concerned about racism in public schools or white teachers being racist to their kids. It would be helpful if they would at least give us an answer on these kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. When you physically divide people by skin color, you have a lawyer coming on saying in a federal lawsuit, it's wrong to divide people based on the color of their skin. This has been a principle in the United States for 50 years. This is wrong. It would be helpful if those people would weigh in on that. We can have the definition debates of
what. Yeah, what about this specific thing? Are you okay with this specific? I think that's what the conversations have to be about.
And many of the Cupertino example where kids were separated, and lots of other examples where you have, you know, this was other one was Illinois. Just there are, you know, Christopher Rufo has compiled a long list of these things. And people say, well, none of that's critical race theory. Well, then what is it? How about another term then that you think is the right term for what these things are? And it can't just be vague and generic, like, well, we'll just call it, you know, social justice, we'll just call it anti-racism. Now, let's talk about this thing of separating people based on skin color, physically separating. It would be helpful if folks on the other side weighed in on that. Can you tell us if that's, is that wrong? Because that would help, I think, a foster understanding and have it be less just a debate about you have the definition wrong.
That's what it's devolved into. It's just been one side screaming one thing. And you have Randy Weingarten from the American Federation of Teachers tweeting over and over again and saying on the news and in statements that we just want to teach an honest version of history. And the thing is, that's not what parents are upset about in most places, in most states. I think it's these instances of the book that was discussed on the clip that we just played, and then also the trainings with people and affinity groups where people are separated on just based on the color of their skin. I think the way to challenge that is we need some reporters asking people from the teachers unions when they get on the news, okay, I get it. You want to teach an honest thing of history.
Is it okay to teach a book with a white devil in the book? Is it okay to separate by skin? Ms. Weingarten, is it okay to separate teachers and students by skin color? Like, ask that question. At least, rather than just letting the other side always say, well, why are you against teaching about racism? Why are you against teaching? We had a clip from 2 weeks ago. Well, why are you against the claim this was about not teaching the Civil War? Anyway, so apart from my microphone breaking, I've been frustrated about that because one side says, what are these things with the white devil lessons? And the other side says, why are you against teaching racism?
Yeah, I mean, so I think some advice for people talking about this going forward is to be specific in exactly what you're talking about so that we don't talk past each other.
Right. Let me add one more thing.
Yeah.
On this realm of the same vein of indoctrination, there's a YouTube video we came across of someone mocking the concept of how much schools do love indoctrinating kids along to one particular ideology. And I wanted to show you guys that.
Hello, class. Today's word for the day is indoctrination. Yes, that means you and you, especially you, and all y'all, okay? All y'all. I'm not playing. Parents, sorry to break it to you, but from the moment your child crosses the thresholds of the school, your child is not your child anymore. While you're busy slaving away at work, pun intended, we have a full 8 hours and 12 years to shape your child's beliefs, attitudes, opinions, and understanding of freedom. You see, the elite moguls don't want competition. They don't want inventors or anyone that will challenge their systems of control. This will completely destroy their control freak nature. It would take power out of their hands and put it into the hands of the people. And they don't want that. First, we erase your imagination. Shh! Don't want the ugly I word said around here. Imagination is for people that think outside of the box. And the elite who write the curriculum don't want outside of the box thinkers. This means trouble for them. And as John D. Rockefeller said, he wants a nation of workers, not thinkers. Little Timmy, are you drawing a purple dragon on your desk? Looks like it's time for your Ritalin. What we have planned for you is a minimum of 8 hours of mind-numbing torture. I mean education. We teach you just enough reading, writing, and math skills to get you working for us. Not enough for you to be truly content with your life, become a successful entrepreneur, or compete with us. Remember, thinking bad, working good. Don't bother. bother using your brain. Who needs that old thing? Here at school, we tell you how to think and what to think.
Oh, God.
Here at school, we tell you what to think. She's making fun of indoctrination. She's talking about how parents are alienated and disenfranchised. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't seeing too much of this pre-COVID.
Yeah, I like how she introduced the Rockefeller quote. I have one from Benjamin Rush in 1786. Our schools of learning, by producing one general and uniform system of education, will render the mass of the people more homogeneous and thereby fit them more easily for uniform and peaceable government. Well, need to make everybody uniform.
Yeah, a time known for such homogeneity in thought, right? When basically there was pretty much a pretty divided population on the revolution alone. So nevertheless. All right.
So I wanted to go over this Washington Post article. You saw it. Washington Post editorial board called out Democrats in Congress for trying to get rid of the DC voucher program. It's been around since around 2005. It had bipartisan support when it started. And there seems to be a constant attack whenever there is a Democrat administration in office when it comes to the DC Opportunity Scholarship Program. So the Post pointed out and questioned in their headline, why are unions and Democrats so opposed to giving poor children a choice in schooling? Problem is, they didn't really answer the question in the article. I'm glad that they called it out and pointed out, hey, you know, there's these other programs for higher education that fund students directly, and you're okay with it. But you're not okay with it when it comes to this program that has students that are over 90% of the students using the program are Black or Hispanic, and they come from average household incomes of around $28,000 per year in the District of Columbia. So they called it out, but they didn't provide the answer. And we know what the answer is, right, Bob?
Of course. I was about to say this. This is the style of presenting information that I do not agree with. I prefer to punch people in the face when they need to be punched in the face. Just this thing of, gee, I wonder why that, like, oh my goodness, why? What? I mean, at least I'll give them credit for bringing up the issue at all. And
thinking emoji.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I give them points for that. But I mean, this has always been a small program, too. I think it's capped as well. It's certainly far less spending per student, something like a third of the spending per student, if not less, than what the district schools in D.C. get to spend. And I think it might be capped in also in terms of size. But you're right. Oddly enough, it just seems like, you know, Barack Obama tried to kill it and then ended up capitulating and, you know, it survived, et cetera. This was, you know, the great Virginia Walden Ford helped create this program. And it was chronicled in a movie called Miss Virginia. This is the program that, you know, they're talking about unions and Democrats trying to kill. Anyway.
And it's in this new House resolution from the Democrats. You go to opportunity, you know, it's like 200 page document. You just look up opportunity and you'll find it because it's the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Mm-hmm. Wrong documents. This one, I have a couple of these open. And you'll see. Trust me, you'll see. It's the Scholarships for Opportunity and Results Act, which is the Opportunity Scholarship Program. And they put in here, they zero it out in starting in fiscal year 2022. Yeah, you can see it right here. I mean, you can kind of scroll in. But $0 requested in the budget. Oh. And you can see that the committee says, the committee expects the administration to phase out the Opportunity Scholarship Program in fiscal year 2023. Hmm. Boom. And that's what the Washington Post was writing about. Hmm. But we all know why. Unions overwhelmingly donate to Democrats. 99% of the American Federation of Teachers funding went to Democrats in the latest election cycle. And the unions don't like competition, so they don't want kids to be able to access private schools at a third of the cost, even though the public schools in D.C. get over $30,000 per kid. You still have families, low-income families, doing as much as they can to get out of those schools, to go to private schools, even though they only get a third of their child's education dollars for doing so, about $10,000 per student.
Yeah. Well, you know, some places, you know, the original Milwaukee voucher program was partly in response to the city being broke. They had this huge, they were in debt actually, and they had this huge fiscal disaster on their hands, and they saved a lot of money by creating a voucher program in Milwaukee where they spent far less per child than had been spent on the traditional public schools. Think of the distinction here. DC gets to print money. Okay, they don't have to worry about fiscal realities. They get to just print money, as and they certainly have it at record levels in the last few months. So maybe that's part of it. I wanted to talk, since we're talking about local districts, I wanted to switch over to that Baltimore story. It was a stunner. Oh, yeah. I saw that.
This it's going is nuts on Twitter right now, too.
Yeah, 41% of high school students earning below a D or below a 1.0 GPA average in Baltimore City schools. And you might say, well, that's just, I guess COVID, the kids didn't have laptops or they weren't logged in. And so they were getting Fs because they weren't there at all. The most amazing thing to me is scrolling down to the story, which is down a bit, I'd say about halfway down. And it says this: during the second quarter of the 2019-2020 school year, just before COVID hit, 24% of high school students had a GPA below 1.0. Drop the mic. This says that a quarter of the kids in Baltimore before COVID weren't even getting a D. A quarter. This is a collapse of a school system. Mm-hmm. How is this not immediately remedied by allowing the parents to go elsewhere with the tuition money that best serves the kid? I'll tell you another thing I thought about when I saw this story. I could be interested in your take, Corey, but is this, yeah, that's the paragraph right there. Is the part that I can't believe they're this honest with grading. How often do you see this? We're talking about grades here, not standardized test scores. A quarter of the kids before COVID weren't even getting a D average. Are you amazed they were like, normally, I mean, I'd be more accustomed to a story of like straight A students proven illiterate. Like, I would think that normally they just give them high grades anyway. I guess if you just don't even show up at all, then they do actually get Fs. And so even before COVID, it was 1/4 of the kids in Baltimore. Now it's 41%.
Well, wasn't there some type of grading scandal going on in Baltimore as well?
Yes.
I think we had talked about it earlier this year. Grading scandal draws apology from school CEO. Maybe that's – thought it was yes. In Baltimore.
And I think there was a large number of schools in Baltimore on a separate story where not a single kid tested proficient in either reading or math. There were a series of schools where not a single kid tested proficient. Of course, that's a standardized test. That I understand more. Here we're just talking about grades.
Grade-changing investigation, 2021.
Yeah. Sure.
Well.
So, you know, maybe they, I don't know. Maybe
those are the boosted numbers. Those are the boosted numbers.
Yeah, maybe we've answered the question, or you just answered the question. They became afraid to change the grades after the media discovered this grade-changing scandal, and so they finally said, all right, if you don't show up at all, I guess you have to get an F. And so now 41% don't even have a D average. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a collapse.
Before pandemic, they spent around $18,000 per student, or last year, I think they spent around $18,000 per student in Baltimore. Yeah. Give that money to the families. Let me find something else.
I mean, this is like I was saying before a few weeks ago, and I think I said it poorly a few weeks ago, Corey, but the idea of like, we'll see kind of technocratic types in our space with, you know, COVID hits, they shut down schools completely for a year. And some of these kind of technocratic types are like, well, let's see, let's think about the best ways to measure the next. It's as if there's a disaster underway And, you know, they're rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic, to use an overused cliche. But it's as if what would it take to get some of these people to respond to a crisis, to see and talk about this as if it's a crisis? Instead, so often I'll see people who I otherwise respect, they're very educated, very intelligent people, you know, writing about education issues. And it's as if you completely close the school for a year, and they're still not even that gets them out of their kind of, you know, technocratic lingo and, wondering about the margins and, you know, wondering about some kind of minor point. Here you have like half the kids not even at a C average. And you wonder if, like in Baltimore, they'd say like, okay, well, let's take this apart. Well, maybe we'll develop a plan over the next 18 months. We'll do the same thing we did before, but we'll call it a slightly different term. And
we need more money.
We'll have a new textbooks. And yes, why don't we introduce, a few more, I don't know, laptops into the school. It's as if they're not aware what's really happening.
I don't think I've sent you this yet, Bob, but we just, the Post story had something about getting rid of the OSP within the committee budget.
Opportunity scholarship.
Bill. Yeah, and there's something else on charter schools in that was presented by House Congressional Democrats in another 200-page document, the first one I opened up that wasn't the right one. But I wanted to go over this, too. There's section 314 on page 165 of this proposal for the Department of Health, Department of Labor and Education, whatever it's called now. Section 314, the proposal by the Democrats, which is about, I saw either 20% or 40% higher than the previous budget. Says in section 314, quote, none of the funds made available by this act or any other act may be awarded to a charter school that contracts with a for-profit entity to operate, oversee, or manage the activities of the school. Looks like they're calling to zero out all federal funding of charter schools that contract with for-profit entities for operational purposes.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah.
I don't think that's ever happened before. Maybe it's been proposed before, but we currently allow funding from the feds to go to all types of charter schools.
Sure. Huh.
So we'll see what happens with it. I mean, they put a lot of other things in there that the Republicans weren't happy with. But look, you know, the Democrats have a majority in the House. So we have the Opportunity Scholarship Program threat from the other bill. And then this one has tucked away on page 165 on four lines, a little provision to zero out federal funding for for-profit charter schools. I don't care if a charter school is for-profit.
Right.
Kids should get the same amount of money regardless of what type of school they go to, whether that's at home, the traditional school that profits in other ways. By compelling students to attend their schools, charter school, profit, nonprofit, private school, nonprofit, or for profit, doesn't matter. It's the choice of the family, and the money should follow them to wherever they're going. But this would zero out a substantial portion of funding.
I have to admit, I'm always a little amused when I see someone identify a scandal of wasteful spending at a charter school, and they'll say, look at this charter school that wasted money. Look, they wasted it here, and they wasted it there, and they wasted it this other place. And I always think to myself, wow, and the families still chose that school.
I wonder how much waste is going on in the residentially assigned school.
And or what they define as waste. Of course, you can hire a lot of low-show people, and that's defined as, you know, not wasting, I guess, but they do nothing for the kids. So along those lines, I wanted to bring up, there's a New Jersey story. You know, since you mentioned this for-profit thing, did you see the one, school district retirement is smooth sailing for state legislator with a $270,000 boat check and $220,000 pension? It's about this guy Sacco, Nicholas Sacco, who has received, I mean, he is, you know, in my opinion, he represents the concept of corruption. I guess I don't want to you know, legally say that he has broken a law. But the fact is so many of these things are legal to do. And, you know, while they, of course, always say that it's the charter and private schools that are profit motivated, right? Mm-hmm. It's the charter and private schools that are greedy. And yet we see that this man is a state senator getting $49,000 a year for that. At the same time, he's also a mayor of a town getting another $40,000 for that. At the same time, he even made $6,800 from just weddings that he did as a part of being mayor, I suppose. And then he's getting this check, which is he gets to cash in 610 retirement days, 601 sick days at his retirement. In other words, over his whole career as a district director of elementary and secondary education, he was making, at the end, by the way, $269,000 for that. But then he got to cash in 601 unused sick days for getting what they call this the boat check. Now, this has been made illegal now in New Jersey. You can't do this anymore. But of course, he was grandfathered in. He's been around so long that they said this practice of having multiple jobs you get simultaneous salaries for.
Jeez.
And also cashing in hundreds of unused sick days for a career that lasts decades is no longer legal in the state. But of course, he's grandfathered in. So there he is with his near $300,000 boat check and his pension of $220,000. Getting simultaneously paid for years through multiple jobs. And all we're told is that it's the charter and private schools that are rooted in greed.
And don't forget to mention Fox News reporting on AFT President Randy Weingarten making over $560,000 per year.
Sure. Why not donate that to the poor, Ms. Weingarten? Why don't you donate half of your salary?
Our work is too important. You know, Bob, we should pay her $1 million for all the great work she's done over the past year to advance school choice. $560 isn't enough. She's been making our case for us. We should pay her ours. But it was an inadvertent endorsement of school choice. So maybe she doesn't deserve $1 million.
Yeah, maybe it's less than $1 million. So let me hit one other too, since we mentioned New Jersey, which is the one from chalkbeat.org, the Newark chalkbeat story, because this was a stunner to me. Newark schools face threat of lower enrollment. Boy, they gave a mild headline to that story, far more mild than it needed to be. That's it. That's the story. Scroll down to below the photo there, you'll see in total, roughly 7,800 students submitted applications this winter, down from the 11,800 the previous year. It went down
34%.
A third of the kids in the state's largest school district have not indicated they feel like coming back. I mean, now they'll say, oh, look, the spokesperson attributed the decline to many disruptions families faced during the pandemic, which might have distracted them from applying to schools. Okay, they have this one application process in Newark where most of the charter schools and the district schools are on like this one form, and you can put like a rank. This high school is my number one choice. This is my number two choice, that kind of thing. So a third of the kids, though, compared to 1 year ago, just we didn't even turn it in. They just didn't even turn it in.
And wouldn't you expect the applications to trend upward since they already lost students the previous year? So like if people were coming back, you would expect these applications to go up, right? I mean, if they were coming back.
I don't know. I couldn't 34% is a stunning number. And to write this off as like, oh, they're a little distracted. I'm sure that, okay, so maybe instead of a 34% drop, it's going to be what? 28% drop because of the families that were just distracted. I mean, it's an enormous number. And this is the kind of headline to me. If I were writing this headline as the editor of Chalkbeat, I would probably like been restraining myself not to swear, you know, like, holy S.
I would have put the 34%.
At least, at a minimum.
I mean, does that suggest that there could be around a 30% reduction in enrollment period? Is that like a leading indicator of enrollment?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yes. I mean, nationwide, we've only seen drops on average of about 3%. 3 to 4%.
This is
huge.
This is a billion-dollar a year school district. It's you know, so anyway, I was kind of struck by that one.
Yep.
All right,
same.
Anything else?
Well, we got to highlight the two inadvertent endorsements of school choice by two people who are not school choice advocates. First, you have the president himself, Joe Biden. He said, and I quote, "Let me be clear. Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation." You could say he's describing the traditional public school monopoly. And a way to fix that would be school choice, competition.
Yeah.
It only applies to certain things, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was fun. And then Randy Weingarten, there was a lot of articles about this blooper, because this had, let's see, how many replies? Over 1,000 replies. Randy says, quote, "Your demography does not decide your destiny, clap. Your zip code shouldn't determine whether you or not you have resources and a quality education." So you can just look at all of the responses. People were having a heyday, especially me, pointing out, well, we're glad you support school choice now. Your zip code shouldn't determine your school. So let families take their education dollars to the school that works best for them. Don't have them residentially assigned to a particular school just because of their zip code.
Yeah, your zip code shouldn't determine whether you have a quality education. Whether your local union wants to close the schools to get more money for themselves, maybe that should determine whether you have a quality education, whether they decide to close your school for their own pockets. Yeah, that's the Randy position, right?
So this has been fun tracking these kinds of tweets and people responding to them. It's been interesting over the past few months, to say the least. Jason Bedrick from EdChoice actually did a poll on it and said, hey, who's been the most effective advocate for school choice on Twitter? Corey or Randy Weingarten?
Yeah.
I voted for Randy. You can see the check mark. Voted for her.
Yeah.
It was an accidental support for school choice. So it was a kind of funny poll. Have anything else that's happened?
No. Good for me.
Yep, I think we are good.
Thanks for watching Random Assignment in this midsummer edition. So we'll see you next week.
And I'll see you next week in South Dakota at Freedom Fest.
Oh, the Badlands.
All right, Bob. Have a good one. Everybody have a great week. Again, this was Random Assignment. Thanks for watching.